I want to thank also Marjorie Gindy for hosting, for opening up your home. Thank you so much, Marjorie, and it's been, there you are, okay, good. Thank you so much for making this possible. It's been a wonderful ride with you the last 3 weeks. It's hard to believe this is it, and I'm going to walk out of here and turn it over, you know, pass the baton to Dr. Kohler, who's taking over the Talmudic section, and talk to Amy and Yvette about the scheduling for all of those things. We're up to the final segment of our journey. We did Bereshit the first week, the rest of the Torah the second week, and the prophets last time. Now we're up to the end of the biblical period. The place to begin for this sort of thing is where we ended last time, which is the destruction of the first temple. The destruction of the first temple, I'm sure I mentioned this last week, and I'll mention it again, was not just a really bad thing that happened. It was a really bad thing that happened. Biblically speaking, it was by far the worst. But it wasn't just that. It wasn't even just that many people got killed and many other people got exiled. It wasn't even that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. The people of Israel basically thought this was the end. The God-Israel relationship was done. The Torah was obsolete and null and void. And that from now on, we're just going to blend in with the rest of the nations of the world, just like everybody else who was conquered by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians did. There was no reason to think that we would be any different. And that's how the people reacted. It was really thanks to Yirmiyahu and Israel, the Navi, and Yechezkel, the Navi, in Babel, in Babylonia, that gave hope to look beyond that dark period. And that's what we talked about toward the very, very end. In addition to the soaring visions of redemption that we read last time, that was very prophetic sounding. In addition to the soaring prophetic visions that we talked about last time, Yirmiyahu gave very prudent, practical advice of how to handle exile, because we had never done that before. So we're going to do our usual custom of reading around the table. Can I call on you to read the first source? And then, again, Hebrew or English. You should all have sources. I believe they were put on your seats.
Thus said the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to the whole community, which I exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat good fruit. Take wives and beget sons and daughters. Mm-hmm. And take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease. And seek the welfare of the city to which I have exiled you, and pray to the Lord in its behalf. For in its prosperity you shall prosper.
So here he's calling on us to pray for the Babylonians who are in the process of destroying the Beit HaMikdash. Right, and this becomes traditionally the origin. You know, in all synagogues, we recite a blessing for the government in the country that we live in. It goes back to this. Right, Yirmiyahu was the one who said, when you live in another country, you pray for that country. You want stability, you want peace, you want them to be good to the Jews, you want them to be good to everybody. And this is really the biblical source that people quote when they want to talk about where does... Yirmiyahu didn't write our prayers that we use for our governments. Those are much, much later. But the source of praying at all during the synagogue service for a government, a foreign government, comes from this. Okay, and then?
Well, thus said the Lord, when Babylon's 70 years are over, I will take note of you, and I will fulfill to you my promise of favor to bring you back to this place.
So here Yirmiyahu is telling his generation to mark their calendars. You know, from the beginning of the Babylonian Empire, the 70-year prediction, Babylonia began as an empire in 605 BCE. That's when Nebuchadnezzar became the king. And Yirmiyahu was saying, mark your calendar, 70 years from then, meaning ballpark 535, that's when two things will happen. What will happen? Babylonia will fall, and we can return and rebuild, exactly. What should we do in the interim? What are we supposed to do over between those 70 years?
Build.
Yirmiyahu's not saying just sit around and mourn. He's not saying sit around and do nothing and wait. No, you got to build a Jewish life. Yirmiyahu is calling on the exile community, which he would become part of shortly thereafter once the destruction took place. But most Jews ended up outside of the land of Israel. We have to build a Jewish life wherever we go. And we have to pray for the stability of the host countries. But we always know, as this source says, and as any prophetic source says, we always return in the end. The point isn't to remain in exile. The point is do your best while you're in exile. And then, of course, we always return to the land of Israel. So that's Yirmiyahu's prediction. I have to tell you, nobody ever listened to poor Yirmiyahu. If you read that book, you get a heartache. You got to love him. He's so dedicated. For 40-plus years, he's prophesying day and night, trying to save the Beit HaMikdash and the people of Israel. And for 40 years, people, at best, ignore him. Then the other stuff, which is they try to poison him to death, throw him into a stockade, throw him into pits, imprison him, persecute him. He has a tough life, okay? Everybody thought he was crazy and wrong. And when it came to predicting the Babylonian downfall, he was even crazier and wronger. How are the Babylonians are going to fall? They beat the Assyrians. I'm not going to get into the Assyrians today other than the Assyrians in their heyday, they did not lose. They were a military mammoth. They were incredible fighters. It's amazing that they fell apart. And the Babylonians beat them. Okay, so think about that. If the Assyrians were invincible and somebody beat them, well, Babylonians are even more invincible. There was no sense whatsoever, not from Babylonia, not from anybody else, that the Babylonians ever would fall. And here's Yirmiyahu saying, mark your calendars, folks, in a couple of generations, the Babylonians will collapse, and we're coming home. Which means not us, not our generation. Yirmiyahu expects that he and his generation will be dead, but you know, little children of his time, perhaps, and then a new generation will grow up and return to the land. Okay, well, amazingly enough, in the year 550 BCE, this is long after Yirmiyahu is gone, the Churban happened in 586. So we're long past exile. Things are bleak. Things are bad. Some guy named Cyrus, he's the king of Persia, decides to revolt against the Babylonians. And the Babylonians did what every empire does when you revolt against them. You stop paying your taxes. We will show up with a huge army and crush you like a bug. And so, lo and behold, the Babylonians sent a huge army to crush Persia like a bug. And Cyrus beat them, which is why, you know, he was gambling. When you don't pay taxes, you know they're going to come. You have to at least hope that you're going to win, right? So he hoped he could win, and he did. And then, this is just nuts. None of this is in Tanakh, but we have plenty of documentation from other, you know, from other literatures that are out there now. The Babylonian Empire, Cyrus is like, hey, I'm just going to crush the whole thing. So he leaves Persia and goes on a rampage against the Babylonian Empire. And the whole thing just falls apart like that. It's amazing. By 539, meaning only 11 years after Cyrus himself revolted, Cyrus is marching to the gates of Babylonia to conquer the capital city of the empire. The Babylonians see him coming. They're all ready for him. And when he arrives, they throw the gates open and welcome their new king. There isn't even a fight. They say, that's it. You're now our king. Welcome to Babylonia. You're now the king of the Babylonian Empire. Because they didn't think they could beat him, right? In other words, they were sure, they were surrendering, but they did it in a very dignified way, right? In other words, they were saying, okay, you're our new king, you win, welcome our new king. But they did it in a dignified way. They didn't want to die. They assumed that Cyrus, at this point, if he can overpower the whole empire, he will overpower them. So why go and go down in a bloodbath? Well, all of a sudden, Cyrus is in charge. Plus, he gets the new nickname in Western civilization books, the Great. Because, hey, he definitely deserves it. Western civilization celebrates mass killers, as you know. You get the title the Great if you conquer enough people, right? So it's amazing to me that that's acceptable. But all the same, read any history book, and Alexander, Cyrus, all these other guys, they become the Great when they're able to kill enough people. That gives them, somehow Western civilization venerates that, and always has. We have a different benchmark for what is considered greatness. In Tanakh, we don't think that, the great warriors, we respect them. David was a great warrior, but even he who was a great warrior, we certainly don't celebrate him as the great warrior king in Israel's past. Right? That's not what made him the Great. And so all the same. So Cyrus, however, did do something that was truly amazing, and that's in source number two. Right after conquering the empire, 1 year later in 538.
והוא פקר עליי לבנות לו בית בירושלים אשר ביהודה. מי בכם מכל עמו, יהי אלוקיו עמו, ויעל לירושלים אשר ביהודה, ויבן את בית השם אלוקי ישראל, הוא האלוקים אשר בירושלים. וכל הנשאר מכל המקומות אשר הוא גר שם, ינשאוהו אנשי מקומו, בכסף ובזהב וברכוש ובהמה, עם הנדבה,
this is unbelievable. Pagan king! All of a sudden, he's divinely inspired, which, again, is a huge discussion we can have a different time about what that means. But whatever it means, he obviously feels inclined to permit the Jews to return. not only can they return, but they can build the Beit HaMikdash with his blessings. And not only that, he says anybody who wishes to remain in Chutz La'aretz, anybody who does not wish to return, does not have to return. He's not forcing anybody to do anything. They should write a check. That's what he says. He says, send, you know, if you don't want to move, you have to make a, you should make a donation to help the, to help your fellow Jews build the Beit HaMikdash. And look how the author, our Navi, who's writing Sefer Ezra, he begins in verse 1, when the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled. It's a thank you note. It's like, you can't believe it. It's a miracle of history. Yirmiyahu predicted this 70 years ago. Nobody thought this could possibly happen. And sure enough, the Babylonians fell, and now the Jews are permitted to return, exactly as Yirmiyahu had said 2 generations ago. He said to mark their calendars, and lo and behold, here we are. If you're a math major, this is 67 years later, right? In other words, it's 605 to 538. That's okay. That's a biblical 70 number. So don't start fretting over the disparity. Only the math majors need worry. But all the same, it's really biblically nothing whatsoever to worry about. And it's amazing what happens next. Throngs of Jews go. If you read Sefer Ezra, throngs of Jews go. Chapter 2 is enormous. It's just a list of, from this family, this number of people. From this city, that number of people. Loads and loads of people start going, and they're headed by exactly the right people. Somebody named Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was from the royal family. He was from Malchut Beit David. So that's the person I want in charge. And he's assisted by somebody named Yehoshua ben Yotzadak. Yehoshua was the grandson of the Kohen Gadol at the time of the destruction. The grandfather, who was serving at the time of the destruction, was murdered by the Babylonians, but his son survived, went into exile, and now the grandson is coming back to serve as the Kohen Gadol. So when you're thinking about redemption, we're off to a great start. Right? Pagan king is allowing the Jews to go back, just as Yirmiyahu said. Throngs of Jews are going. They're being led by the right people, the descendant of Malchut Beit David, the Davidic kingdom, and the grandson of the Kohen Gadol. And these people are righteous, and they're enthusiastic, and they're going. It really sounds like everybody's going. Until you get to the final tally in source number 3, after this immense list, notice that we're up to verse 64 in the chapter now. Okay, so all of a sudden you start, okay, I don't know what the total Jewish population was in those days. You don't know. But when you hear this number, it's a lot smaller than I was hoping for.
20%?
I don't know. I don't know how many people were there. But Megillat Esther, of course, which happens after this, you get the impression that most Jews don't even live in Israel. In fact, you would never have thought that during the Megillah, there is this community living in Israel. Right? It sounds like the center of Jewish life is somewhere else. Okay, so that means most people didn't go. Well, why didn't they go?
Comfortable.
It seems like they're just comfortable, right? There's no reason given other than that. They had permission to go from the pagan emperor, so nobody was in prison, nobody's being held back, they're not being enslaved. Most people simply had become comfortable over 2 generations. Like 2 generations ago, they all thought, oh no, life is over. The people of Israel are over. But by now, they listened to Yirmiyahu very well. They built their houses of worship. They built their schools. They built a strong Jewish life in the diaspora. And now they're very happy.
Same place where we are today.
Huh? As I said, I'm sure at the beginning, and I'll say it again now, you're of course correct. And again, I don't do anything preachy. I'm living in America also. It's something that I think about good and hard. My job is to present the biblical vision. I think I'm doing as you can see, I'm trying to be objective in the sense I'm not trying to couch anything. I think that the biblical picture is pretty straightforward on this issue. But yeah, a lot of this material is eerily relevant to our world as well. So one Navi who became active shortly after this wave of Aliyah was a man named Zechariah, one of the last of the prophets. Zechariah, at the beginning of his book, he became active in the year 520 BCE, so about 18 years after this original Aliyah. And what had happened, I don't want to burden, you know, without going into the details, the enemies of the Jews, there were people there who did not want us to build the Beit HaMikdash for all kinds of reasons, which we're not going to go into right now, but they persecuted us. They made sure that we stopped. They threatened to write letters to the emperors saying the Jews are rebelling and the reason why they want to build Yerushalayim is to revolt against Persia. No emperor ever wants to hear about a revolt. That makes them very nervous. And so the Jews were so scared of Persian, if the Persians came and attacked us, we'd be done. And they knew that as well as the enemies knew that. So the Jews got scared and stopped building. So 2 Nevi'im, Haggai and Zechariah, began to prophesy in the year 520 BCE. to try to get the Jews to get back to work. And it worked. They inspired them, and they actually did get back to work. Zechariah had a whole series of really interesting and complicated visions. The one that's relevant for today is the one that we see in source number 4.
Okay. I'm going to pass it this one.
Pass it on, okay. So would you like to do source number 4? Yeah.
Okay, 4. I looked up and I saw a man holding a measuring rod.
By the way, in these visions, that man is an angel. In other words, he's in the heavenly host seeing angelic visions, okay?
Where are you going, I asked. To measure Yerushalayim, he replied, to see how long and wide it is to be. But the angel who talked with him came forward, and another angel came forward to meet him. The former said to him, run to the young man and tell him, Yerushalayim shall be peopled as a city without walls. So many shall be the men and cattle it contains. And I myself, declares the Lord, will be a wall of fire all around it. And I will be a glory inside.
Okay, so let's pause here because we got to talk about, that's the vision part, and then we'll have the next person read from 10 and on. Vision. Zechariah sees an angel measuring Yerushalayim, and the prediction, what's going on, Zechariah always needs to know. It's hard to understand these visions, so thankfully he has an angel in the visions telling him what's going on, which helps us because now we know what's going on. So the angel tells him that Jerusalem shall be peopled as a city without walls. Okay, what's the historical reality in 520 BCE regarding the walls of Yerushalayim? They're still down. They've been breached. The Babylonians breached the walls in 586 en route to destroying the Beit HaMikdash, and the Jews haven't had a chance to build them yet. Okay. You know how bad that is? And it's not just a bad security situation, which it most certainly is, but in the good old days, you know, like ask any New Yorker, what's the definition of a real city? And the answer is New York and New York alone. We all know that, right? Okay, but if you ask ancient people, what's the definition of a real city? It's a wall. Walled cities are real. And open cities are villages or whatever. It's out-of-towners. That's the sticks. Everybody understood that if you live in a walled city, that's a real city. So to have a breach, Yerushalayim is our city. It's like our capital city, okay? If that city is breached, that is severely humiliating. As in, like, I can't even imagine how painful it was to the Jews to have their capital city, the city of God, the capital of their kingdom, which wasn't a kingdom anymore, in ruins, with the walls open, meaning it's an unwalled city. Do you want to know how humiliating this is? You and I can appreciate this. You know, we're not there, so we don't appreciate what an ancient person feels. But here's halakha for you. You know, on Purim, the practice is that most Jews in the world celebrate Purim on the 14th day of Adar. But as you know, there's something called Purim Shushan, which some people call Shushan Purim, where people celebrate on the 15th day. Okay, who celebrates on the 15th? Walled cities. In other words, since Shushan was a real city. Okay, so now walled cities celebrate in solidarity with Shushan. So walled cities, as we know, celebrate on the 15th. Okay, now as you know, you don't have to be a great historian here. Well, in the history of any city, there are times that it might have a wall, and there are times that it might not have a wall. So we don't keep changing the rule. Let's say we built a wall around Brooklyn tomorrow. Brooklyn would not suddenly start observing on the 15th day of Adar. Okay, so you have to pick a point in history where it counts, where that's the decisive moment in halacha, where if there was a wall at this moment, you celebrate on the 15th, and if there was not a wall at that moment, then you celebrate on the 14th. So if we were the council of halachists, what date would we say? If there's a wall, at what time would we celebrate Purim Shushan? Yes, it's a no-brainer. This is one of the greatest no-brainers ever. It's obvious that the walled cities at the time of the Purim story should be considered real cities in halacha and celebrate on the 15th day. But, and by the way, there was one rabbi in the Talmud who ruled that way. And he was thoroughly overruled by everybody else. Everybody else picked a different date. Well, what date did they pick?
14.
No, not the 14th. Meaning from what time period do you need a wall? From the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. Now, I love Yehoshua ben Nun, really. I can give lots and lots of shiurim about him. But what in the world does Yehoshua ben Nun have to do with the Purim story? Answer, zero. Right? None. He's centuries and centuries before. This is the weirdest psak halacha ever. it's so obvious that the minority view that we should do it from the time of the Purim story is correct. Historically, he is correct. That's who would have celebrated in solidarity. But Halakha thoroughly overrules that view in favor of the walls from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. Why? And the answer, the Talmud explains. Because if we would have done the obvious and ruled in accordance with the Purim story, the walls of Yerushalayim were not built yet. And that means that Halakha would rule that Yerushalayim is not a real city. We won't allow that to happen. So we picked this random, way back when, Yehoshua ben Nun, just because then the wall of Yerushalayim was standing. It wasn't even a Jewish city yet. Too bad, there was a wall, it's a real city. Halakha would never rule that Yerushalayim is not a real city. It's just too humiliating. So that creates a warped historical halakha.
What percent of the walls have to be standing? Because some were, when Nehemiah goes to rebuild,
it was breached. But it was breached. Nehemiah, you're right. It wasn't that there was no wall. It wasn't an open city. There were still plenty of stones all over the place, but there were huge breaches. It was not considered a walled city. And that was considered, in Sefer Nehemiah, as long as you're mentioning him, repeatedly uses the word cherpa, which can be loosely translated as cherpa. Right? It's a cherpa. It's a shame of the people of Israel. Right? It was so shameful to the people of Israel that the walls were down. So Zechariah, in the year 520, going back to his vision, the walls were down. The walls are breached. I mean, Amy's right. That's a better way to say it. The walls were breached. There were holes in it everywhere because the Babylonians barged in. That's how they got into the city. Most Jews saw the breached walls as a terrible, shameful thing, which it was if you're a regular human being. Now let's look at the vision again. What's Zechariah saying?
The
current situation could be a blessing. Imagine if Yerushalayim's population expanded so greatly that the walls would serve as a constraint. So it's good that there are breaches because then you could build what we call a new city. Jews will have to...
It's expandable because
the walls are breached. And when Zechariah is looking beyond the shame of the reality, and this vision is incredibly hopeful, he's saying the population is going to erupt so much that you don't want a wall. Well, then the question, God addresses security concerns, because we always have to address security concerns. Oh, the whole point of a wall is to give you security. It's not just a badge of honor. So God says, I will be a wall of fire for you. What he's saying is, I will personally protect you. You don't need that wall. Take advantage of the breached walls and have a huge population explosion. Go beyond the walls of the old city. Go to the new city. Build Yerushalayim like it's never been built before. This is a great opportunity. That's shot in the vision. Now, that's the Zechariah looking beyond a terribly bleak reality and saying what potential there is right now to take advantage of the breached walls and turn it into the best thing that's ever happened to us. It's amazing. Well, how is that vision going to become a historical reality? Well, you need people to move there, right? In other words, it's not enough to envision, oh, this could be an opportunity. If people don't move, well, then nothing is going to happen. So Zechariah moves out of vision land and starts talking to the people very directly. And for this, we go to verse 10, still in source 4, and we'll move to the next person down. That's the middle of the paragraph.
Yeah. And I myself, declares the Lord, will be a wall of fire all around it, though I swept you there.
Like time out. You skipped one line. I apologize. Okay. If you go back one line from where you are, just you jumped over a line. So you see where there's a little 10 away?
And I will be a glory inside, away.
There you go.
Flee from the land of the north, says the Lord. Though I swept you there like the four winds of heaven, declares the Lord. Away, escape, O Zion. You will dwell in fair Babylon.
So here Zechariah is calling to the Jews who have chosen to remain in Babylonia. Folks, escape! Get out of there. You got to come here. If you want this vision to become reality, we need a big population influx. Right now there's 42,360, and that's all over the whole country. Right? If we want to make this vision a reality, we need to get there. So he just calls on them to come. In other words, he realizes that his vision is a state of potential. It's not something that's going to happen automatically. It's something that could happen, but it requires Jewish participation. Okay, carry on. Verse 14 now.
Shout for joy, fair Zion, for lo, I come, and I will dwell in your midst, declares the Lord. In that day, many nations will attach themselves to the Lord and become his people, and he will dwell in your midst. Then you will know that I was sent to you by the Lord of hosts.
The Lord will take Judah to himself as his portion of holy land, and he will choose Jerusalem once more.
So here the people feel rejected. God is going to choose Jerusalem again. Fun fact. This is the only place in all Tanakh that the land of Israel is called the Holy Land. Christians got very into this, which is how it became the Holy Land. It's something that you hear all the time. But it comes from this verse in Zechariah. So it's a Jewish thing. It's okay to call it that if that is your inclination. But all the same, we were always about the land of Israel. In other words, to us, that was our title for it. But here you get the one place where it's called the Holy Land. And the land has nothing to do with it. It's not that the dirt is holy. There's nothing in the land that makes it different from anything else. It's a non-essentialist type of holiness. It's the place where God and Israel fulfill their covenant, right, that we talked about in the previous few weeks. So I just wanted to note, as long as we're in the source, that this is the only place where you have that expression in all of Tanakh. It's a relatively late terminology. So what Zechariah is saying, once again, is that it's up to us. The potential is there. God has made mountains move, and Cyrus has permitted the Jews to come back. Yirmiyahu's vision is being fulfilled, and some of that was God's hand back behind the scenes. Some of it requires the Jewish hand to take an active role to bring about the full redemption. That's what Zechariah called upon. I don't need to tell you, unfortunately, most Jews did not heed this call. And in the end, 75 years later, Nehemiah came to rebuild the walls. In other words, there was no, and in fact, not only was there not a population boom, but Yerushalayim's population was so tiny in Nehemiah's time that he actually ordered 1/10 of the Jewish population in Israel to move to Yerushalayim because it wasn't a viable city. Yeah.
Do you know how many Jews there were in Israel before the temple was destroyed the first time?
I do not know.
So nobody knows what the percentage is.
Do not know. In other words, it's hard to know how many people were killed, how many were exiled, how many got lost along the way, how many remained behind altogether after all of these waves of exile. There simply are not enough numbers given to even stab at a guess. So it seems like a widespread destruction, widespread exile, but we don't have a sense of concrete numbers. The only way that we get a sense that 42,360 is not particularly big is, again, from Zechariah saying, come on, guys, move back already, and from Megillat Esther, where, again, you get the impression that most Jews live in the diaspora. Most Jews have chosen not to return to the land of Israel. So, but it's an impression rather than a numerical evaluation. We just don't know. Okay. So that's Zechariah calling on the potential of that time. Now, another thing that Zechariah envisions as something that will happen in potential is in source number 5. Okay, now up to the next source.
For mark well this stone which I placed before Joshua, a single stone with 7 eyes. I will execute its engraving, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will remove that country's guilt in a single day.
Okay, so now we have to review back to something we talked about 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, we talked about how in the Torah, certain sins, particularly severe ones, pollute the actual land of Israel so that the land of Israel gets sick and spews its inhabitants out. And in the Torah, there's no purification process for the land. The only way the land can cure itself is to exile the Jews, or before that, to exile the Canaanites, to exile its inhabitants. But there's no purification process. The Beit HaMikdash, there's a purification process. We have Yom Kippur, both teshuvah and rituals that actually keep the Beit HaMikdash pure so that God can dwell there. But there's no way to purify the land.
Even through
Shemitah? Shemitah is something that we are obligated to do, but the land, but that doesn't purify the land. That's just the right thing to do with the land, and not doing it is a problem. Right?
It's not hesitant.
Huh?
It's not hesitant.
No. If there's adultery and idolatry and murder and violation of Shemitah, the land is polluted, and the land it spews out its inhabitants. There's no way to purify the land other than exile. Right? Here, this is a very important moment, actually, in Zechariah's prophetic stint. If you know that background, he's saying that God himself will purify the land, because God is the only one who can. Right? There is no ritual. There's nothing B'nai Israel can move there. They can live holy lives. We can do our side of the covenant, but there's no way to clean up the land from its impurities. So God himself gets involved and says, I will clean it up. And this is graphically depicted in chapter 5 of Zechariah. You would have to read the whole chapter, so I didn't feel like it was worth a source in a source sheet because, you know, time is time. But I'll tell you what happens there. Chapter 5, you can read it all yourself. Never need to trust me. Chapter 5 of Zechariah, the first half of the prophecy is about how God will get the sinners out of the land of Israel. And then the second part is how God will remove sin from Israel. And the idea is that God is cleaning up the land. The land is now going to finally be fit for God's presence to return and fit for a holy nation to be able to live a life of holiness again.
What does the stone have to do with it?
Nobody knows what that stone is talking about. That's a good question.
Is it Zechariah? One of those stones from when they crossed the Jordan River? Is that what they...
It's a visionary stone. Something in Zechariah's vision, and there's a massive machloket. There are certain elements in Zechariah's vision that are basically incomprehensible, right, in the sense that everybody just speculates, but nobody, to this day, nobody is sure. And Rashi and Ibn Ezra both open up their commentaries on Zechariah saying, man, this book is hard. they don't say it quite in those words, but not, look at it, you'll see, not that far away, not that far away. So there are certain details of the visions that I just, you know, when I give shiurim on it, I just quote, okay, here are three opinions, but we really have no clue. And that's sort of how I handle it, because we really have no clue. Okay, so getting back to our issue at hand, so Zechariah was living at a time in 520 where there was pulsating hope for Mashiach to come, for the land to be purified. The sinners will repent or get out of the land. God himself will purify the land of Israel, so really Chadesh Emenu Kekedem. The Jews will need to move back to the land of Israel to fulfill the full vision. That did not happen. And instead, this potential state, as we all know, did not happen. Mashiach did not come then. It was a half-baked redemption. And on the one hand, we got our Beit HaMikdash. We got Kibbutz Galiyot, many Jews did return, but no question that we did not get the whole package. As the sages observe, the Beit HaMikdash was there, but there was no ark in it, which is kind of the reason why you have a Beit HaMikdash. There was no Shekhinah, you didn't feel God's presence. Prophecy was coming to an end. The fire from heaven that existed in the first temple was not there anymore. So you get this sense that it's a very, very far cry from what the full redemption is supposed to be. So within two generations, it's really crazy. The generation of the exiles were able to say in source number 6, a very celebrated pasuk from Sefer Tehillim. Okay, move it over to source 6.
How can we sing the song of the Lord on alien soil?
So the exiles were saying, what are we doing here? We're broken. Can we ever pray to God again? Well, two generations later, the answer was, we figured it out. Right? Within two generations, the people built Jewish life. We figured out how to pray to God on alien soil. We didn't think of it as alien soil anymore. We just thought of it as, okay, this is our home. And that's what happened. So as a result, the majority of Jews remained in the exile. And some people, by the way, just a footnote, there are many religious Zionist teachers today that favor the notion of interpreting Megillat Esther as, you see, because we remained in exile, that's why this happened. I'm a good religious Zionist. I love Megillat Esther. But that is certainly not the message of the Megillah. So I just want to clean that one up in case you've ever heard that one before. First of all, it's impossible to say that the main message of the Megillah is something that's not written anywhere in the Megillah. That just doesn't make any sense at all. And second of all, the bigger problem, honestly, is that Haman's decree affected the Jews in Israel as much as the Jews of Shushan. I don't know why that point gets lost when this thing is done. So it's not, I don't know why the story happened, but it's extremely difficult to interpret Megillat Esther along those lines. I hear this interpretation often, I have to say, but I believe that it is mistaken. The Jews should have returned to Israel, excuse me, but I don't think that Purim story was a divine reprimand for not doing that. But what happened by Jews not making Aliyah is that Mashiach didn't come. It's a bigger problem. That the redemption of the Nevi'im envisioned simply was not fulfilled because the Jews were unable to see that. Of course. He was God's, yeah, but not Mashiach, like the way we use the term.
Maybe that's only using it wrongly.
It just means that he was God's agent through history to bring the redemption, which he most certainly was. But it doesn't mean the Messiah, the way that that we colloquially use the term today. Okay, so this all being said, in Brachot, sources 9 and 10, two Talmudic passages, we'll skip 8 for now. The Talmud jumps upon this point. Okay, so we move it over, source 9.
Similarly, it has been taught, till thy people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over that thou hast gotten. Till thy people pass over, O Lord, this is the first entry into the land. Till the people pass over that thou hast gotten. This is the second entry.
Old English notwithstanding, all that is from Azi Ashir. Azi Avoram Chadonai, Adi Avoram Zukanita. Okay? That's what it's quoting, okay?
Hence the sages say, the intention was to perform a miracle for Israel in the days of Ezra, even as it was performed for them in the days of Joshua ben Nun, but sin caused the miracle to be withheld.
The Talmud understands very well that this was that the Second Temple period, the Mashiach could have come. There could have been a full-blown redemption with all the miracles, absolute, going back to Chadesh Emenu Kekedem, restoration of the good old days. But it was a half-baked thing because of sin. The Talmud here, of course, helpfully does not tell us what sin it is. So we have no clue. But the dominant view within our Parshanut is the failure to return to the land of Israel. just based on the prophecies of Zechariah and others who were talking about this. They said, the potential is here. All the historical variables that were needed were in place. Cyrus was giving the Jews the green light to do everything we needed to do to bring redemption. He was giving us that freedom, and we didn't opt into that freedom, or at least not enough of us did. Some did, but the overwhelming minority. One Talmudic passage that already adopts this view is in source number 10.
If she be a wall, we will build upon her a turret of silver. If she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Had you made yourself like a wall and had all come up in the days of Ezra, you would have been compared to silver, which no rottenness can ever affect. Now that you have come up like doors, you are like cedar wood, which rottenness prevails.
So the idea is that if you had come up like a wall, if everybody would have moved back, we would have been like silver. There would have been no rot over the community of the Second Temple period. But instead, we came up like cedar wood. Cedar is a wonderful, wonderful wood, but simultaneously it rots. And so that's what the passage is saying. The idea is that it wasn't a lasting redemption because we came up bit by bit by bit. It's not doors the way that you and I have doors. It's like the word that we would use is not doors, it's shutters. So imagine shutters, like little pieces of wood, one after the other after the other. So we came in trickles, but that wasn't enough to affect a permanent redemption. And so the Talmud already says that, and many later commentators follow suit. There are two final Second Temple period quotations to bring out right now, and then we can bring it all home as we wind down the series. Okay, source number 11. The Jews continued in the Second Temple period, besides being comfortable in the exile. The Jews who lived in Israel continued to feel that God had rejected them. So Malachi, the very last of the prophets, says in source number 11,
I have shown you love, said the Lord, but you ask, how have you shown us love? After all, declares the Lord, Esau is Jacob's brother, yet I have accepted Jacob and rejected Esau. I have made his hills a desolation, his territory a home for beasts of the desert. And Edom thinks, though crushed, we can build the ruins again, say the Lord of hosts. They may build, but I will tear down. And so they shall be known as the region of wickedness, the people down forever of the Lord. Your eyes shall behold it, and you shall declare, great is the Lord beyond the borders of Israel.
So the Jews who lived in Israel, who were suffering poverty, famine, drought, all kinds of stuff, they weren't happy, and they thought maybe God has really still rejected us, even though we're living in the land of Israel. So Malachi says, he gives a very sobering answer. He doesn't say, oh, Mashiach is right around the corner. What he says is, the mere fact that God has given us back the land of Israel should prove to us God's love of Israel. That was God's promise. It seemed impossible, and here we are. Look at Edom, our neighboring brother from Esav, the descendants of Esav. The Babylonians crushed Edom. They'll never rebuild. They're done. They've ceased to exist as a nation. The fact that we're here is the true sign of God's love, and I have to say, one of the greatest miracles ever is the fact that we're here. It's truly incredible that the people of Am Yisrael chai, and that we have, and even more so, that we have the land of Israel back. So Malachi in the Second Temple period is saying it's an absolute miracle of history. Don't lose sight of that, even though we're downtrodden and oppressed and under the Persian thumb. It's a miracle, and this is a sign of God's love. A more upbeat tone, which is something that we actually have co-opted for our daily tefillah, comes from the very late book of Nehemiah, source number 12. Yeah, keep it moving. Who are we up to? So this is something we say in the daily prayers, right? It comes from this passage over here. It was a prayer that was said in the time of Nehemiah. And the idea is that God, you chose Abraham, and you promised him the land. And behold, here we are living in the land. You've kept your word. Thank you. So that's a more upbeat way of saying the same thing that Malachi said in the depths of despair, as people are feeling, oh my goodness, maybe it's all over still. Malachi says, no, God really does love us permanently, and the people of Nehemiah's time are making that point into a tefillah. They're saying that the mere fact that we are in the land of Israel shows God's eternal promise. And that was the end of the biblical period. Right? Nehemiah was really the end chronologically of it all. This was one great reformation. And the people were starting to learn that even though Mashiach wasn't coming, there's still this eternal God-Israel connection, and the fact that we were back in the land of Israel was a sign of this eternal covenant. Now, moving ahead to now, just taking the four shiurim together and weaving them together, we go back to Professor Yehuda Elitzur. I quoted him in week one, and now we give him a little more airtime. Yehuda Elitzur taught at Bar-Ilan University for many years. He was an expert in Tanakh, really an excellent, excellent teacher. I didn't have him. He died in 1999, but I'm a big fan of his writings. So he wrote an article on just the religious standing of the land of Israel in Tanakh. Good article, and it came in handy for this series just to make sure I had all my sources straight. But he added a few points beyond the biblical references, which I could have done, for the most part without his help. So he makes several really good points from within the Tanakh itself. One is something that we've already discussed. I just want to review this point because it's so important. Source number 13.
I assign the land you sojourn in to you and your offspring to come. All the land of Canaan as an everlasting holding, I will be their God.
So point number one is what we discussed back in weeks one and two, that God promises Avraham Avinu the land to him and his descendants eternally. It's an everlasting holding, achuzat olam. So our medieval commentators were bothered by that because the whole rest of the Torah keeps on threatening exile if we sin. What do you mean achuzat olam? We're not olam. We got kicked out. So a whole bunch of medieval commentators jump in with the obvious resolution that we've discussed already in this series, which is the land belongs to the people of Israel whether or not we live there. Right? The Achuzat Olam, this land will always belong to Avraham Avinu and his descendants through the people of Israel, even if we've been exiled for our sins. If we want to have the privilege of living in Israel, then we need to be good. Right? That's conditional. That part is totally contingent on Israel's behavior. But the ownership of the land, that's an eternal God Avraham covenant, and that's unbreakable. And that's what the people in Nehemiah's time in the previous source were saying. They're like, look, here we are, we're back. It really is our land eternally. You were God, you kept your word. Well, of course, that point becomes vastly more poignant. The Nehemiah people were 70 years or so of exile. So what happens after 2,000 years of exile? Well, now it's even more incredible that Jews have returned to the land. Because you realize the miracle that is, A, that we're here at all, and B, that we have regained our land. Professor Elitzur points out, there's a general rule of history. When lands get conquered, they don't remain desolate. People move there. Either the conquerors themselves annex the land and free real estate, who doesn't want it? The land of Israel is beautiful. Take over. Or you repopulate it with other peoples, if you're in the business of doing that. The Assyrians liked doing that. That was their policy. They didn't want the lands to go desolate, because that would ruin their empire. They want tax. The best way to get tax is keep everything prosperous and then send very hefty bills. And that's how the Assyrians ran their empire. That's normal. Well, God promises in the Torah, exile is the biggest curse. It's the biggest one of the klalot. It's the ultimate problem and punishment for sin. That's the only thing that exile is in the Torah. Well, in source number 14, the klalot, okay, so turn it over.
I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled by it. And you I will scatter among the nations, and I will unsheath the sword against you. Your land shall be a desolation, and your cities a ruin.
To me, that sounds very bad. I always take a naive reading. This time it's not hard to have this naive reading. That's my policy. I like taking naive readings. I think that it just helps understand what's really there. And then you play out different possibilities of how to read it. This sounds bad. This sounds really, really, really bad. And along comes a midrash, an ancient halachic midrash on this passage. And says, Zo midah tova shebeporanu. This is a blessing in the curses. They're a lot more hopeful sounding. And I'm a pretty optimistic guy. But this sounds horrible. The Midrash says it's a blessing that the land will remain desolate, because that means it will always be waiting for us to return. So Professor Elitzur, writing from the vantage point of 2,000 years later, is able to say, holy cow, that Midrash is so spot on. Lands don't remain desolate. Lands are taken over either by the occupier, the conquering nation, or other people move in because it's now available, right? But the land of Israel always remained desolate after the Jews left. It's actually incredible. And Professor Elitzur goes on to point out, the Canaanites, it's really interesting, who lived there before we did, they at least understood how to mine the natural resources of the land of Israel. They were very wealthy. And the Torah even says, hey guys, you're coming into this land, there's going to be some great luxury homes to be had, in source number 15, the very last source. Yeah, you're going to come to this beautiful land and you're going to inherit all these homes and fields and everything. Even the bad spies, for all of their complaining, they still thought the fruit was awesome, right? Like the Canaanites at least knew how to work the land and prosper there, right? Interestingly, though, they never became a nation. We call them the Canaanites. It's a nice catch-all phrase, but Yehoshua ben Nun, when he battled against the Canaanites, he conquered 31 kings living in that land. And they were city-states. They weren't a nation, and they were city-states that hated each other's guts and fought with each other all the time, right? They might form coalitions against Yehoshua because that was prudent, but they didn't like each other. They had nothing to do with each other. The land of Israel never had a single nation live there as a unified nation. The Canaanites, however, at least knew how to exploit the resources of the land. After the Jews left, it was a wasteland. Not only was there not a single nation that was able to live there as a nation, but it became an absolute barren wasteland. Nobody exploited its resources. Ramban, Nachmanides, he came from Spain at the very end of his life in the 13th century. He was really fleeing Spain, but he came to Israel. He was shocked about how it was just a total wasteland. He couldn't believe it. Looking around, there were pockets of people. It wasn't zero, population zero, but it wasn't far away from that. And he said, this proves the klalot. God said he was going to leave a desolation. Here I am. He died in 1267. Here I am before the year 1267. I'm looking around here. Nobody's home. It's exactly what God promised in the Torah. What a bracha. The land is waiting for us. He understood very, very well. Somebody who didn't realize the miraculous side of it, but who was equally shocked, was Mark Twain in the 19th century, in the celebrated quotation. He did a big world tour. And the thing that shocked him the most was that Israel, he knew something about Tanakh. He couldn't believe Israel was an absolute barren wasteland. Nobody was home. It's like, this place, what a dump. He wrote it a little, he was a good writer, so he said it a little more articulately than that. But basically, all he was saying is, what a dump. You can go online and get the exact quotation, right? I mean, I did on the way down just to, you know, see it again. I've seen it many, many times over the years. But that's a miracle. God promises here in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu that when you are exiled, the land will always remain a barren wasteland, so that you can return. That only works if nobody else occupies the land. If somebody else occupied the land, we wouldn't be able to come home. It's amazing. Here's another rule of history. All other people throughout history, when they get exiled from a land, they either assimilate into the new culture, or if they're big enough, they take over someplace and they become the culture, like the Brits who came to here. So their culture dominated and they simply became the new culture in a new land. Right, or Spain taking over Argentina, or all these other Hispanic nations, right? That Spain simply exerted its influence and became the dominant culture. Those are the two things that you do when you leave your homeland. You either take over if you're big, or you assimilate if you're small. And here God says in Source 14, we already read it, that Chem ezare bagoyim, I'm going to scatter you among the nations. That's bad, but what it means is that we'll never be big enough to take over anything. And sure enough, 2,000 years later, Professor Elitzur can say this curse was fulfilled, but with the blessing. The Jews will never be able to build a homeland somewhere else and take over some other place and become the dominant culture. And amazingly, this is the bigger miracle, here we are. We didn't all assimilate away. Some did, I don't need to tell you that, many did even. But all the same, even though we were scattered and downtrodden, that was a blessing in terms of preserving A, our identity, and B, our sense that we need to go home, which is why we were able to have a 2,000 dream that one day we're going to go back to the land of Israel. Professor Elitzur then says something that was so powerful when I read it, and I hope you appreciate this line also, but when he said it, he's like, what a great summary of the whole course. I love this line. So I will share it with you as a summary of the whole course. The whole point, according to Tanakh, is the Jewish people and the land of Israel need each other. When they are together, the land prospers, it blooms, and the people are in their covenantal land. And when the Jews are out of Israel, the Jews suffer, and the land goes desolate. He is so right. It's exactly what Tanakh is predicting thousands of years ago, and it's exactly what the course of history did. It's absolutely amazing. So the point of the whole course has been that, of course, the Torah, which was given outside of the land of Israel, is binding everywhere. We all know that, and it's true. The Torah was meant to be an eternal covenant with the people of Israel wherever we live. But the heart and soul of where the covenant is to be realized is the promised land, is the land of Israel. There's no question. We live in an age of incredible miracle. I mean, it's what a bracha it is that we live in an age where the Jewish people have control over the land of Israel. You never could have predicted this one, right? Talk about, nobody could have imagined Yirmiyahu would be right then. Nobody could have imagined that this would ever go back, even though the Nevi'im predicted it thousands of years ago. And suddenly, we have this opportunity. So on the one hand, that comes with an immense sense of gratitude to God, and it also comes, as our history has shown us, and as all Tanakh is all about, it's a challenge to all of us to build up the land in every way that we can, to feel our solidarity with the people of Israel, to do whatever we can to build the land, and to realize that that's really where it's all about. And on that, I end the biblical side of this discussion. Before, I just want to make sure to do what I need to do. I wanted to use this opportunity, first of all, to thank all of you. This has been amazing. I was looking forward to this so immensely from the moment that Amy first reached out, and and I had a lot of preparation to do. I've never given shiurim like this before. It was so worth it just to be able to come and learn with you. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I want to thank Amy and Yvette for all of your work, both behind the scenes and in the scenes, to really make everything work so well. I also want to thank the SCA, you know, Murray and the whole Sephardic Community Alliance for having the vision to have this series. It's really an amazing thing. They do so much great work. I want to thank the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals. I'm coming with that hat on, right? So that's what I do. My father and I, you can go to our website. It's on every one of your source sheets, including this one. What we're basically trying to do for the world, what the SEA is trying to do for Brooklyn, and it's a very similar vision. I had a wonderful Shabbat in Deal this past summer, where I really sat down with some of the heads of the SEA, and I'm like, wait a minute, we're basically doing the same thing. We're just looking nationally and beyond, and the SEA is doing it for the community right here in Deal, of course. So I want to thank the Institute for making this possible. Again, for more information, you can go to our website. I want to thank the hosts who opened up, you know, your homes. It's a big deal. I know it's a big deal to get the home ready and to set it up and to open it up for everybody. And so the people who were generous enough to do that, I want to thank that. I also want to express my sincere jealousy of all of you. I'm done, but I'm not going to get to hear the rest of the series. Right? So I was lucky to get this part, but that's it. I go on to my next teaching endeavors. That's what I do. But you are in for such a treat of this, you know, a full spanning series that goes far beyond the biblical period, which is where my world ends, and onto the rabbinic period and beyond. And of course, you could talk to Amy, Yvette, or Murray, or others, or else you've been bombarded with emails for all I know. And you already know the whole schedule for that. But I think it's an amazing, amazing series that you've put together. So I am honored and privileged to have been part of that. So I thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.